It's been one of the best projects we've done, I think, in terms of our building, putting a heart back into the community, because we were a rural area. There's no other commercial facilities in our area except what we have, the shop and the post office. And up until the cafe opened, there was nowhere where people could get together and sit down and have a cup of tea and a chat. You had to go into Maharaj, you had to go to the nearest town to do that.
Welcome to the From Passion to Action podcast, a discussion about social innovation and social entrepreneurship from Dublin City University. I'm Dr. Eimear Ní Bhorádaí.
I'm Donica Kinlan.
And I'm Mita Power. In this series, we talk to academic experts in social innovation and entrepreneurship, social entrepreneurs who have founded their own social enterprises, and community organizations that are contributing to meaningful social change.
The aim of these conversations is to delve into the concepts of social innovation and entrepreneurship in theory and in practice, to discuss why they are important in today's society, and above all, to explore ways to embed these concepts in higher education across different disciplines.
The From Passion to Action project is based at Dublin City University and funded by the National Forum for the Enhancement of Teaching and Learning in Higher Education. We hope that you enjoy sharing these materials as well with your colleagues and with your students. You're very welcome to this podcast as part of From Passion to Action, our series of interviews, podcasts, conversations with people who are involved in social innovation and social entrepreneurship. So the first question I'd like to ask you, Neil, is what's the first word that you think of when you hear the concepts social innovation and social entrepreneurship?
Well, it's hard to put it into one single word, but I suppose from our point of view, and it's really all about sustainability and community sustainability, and in many ways, getting off the grant treadmill that a lot of groups get into, and is trying to put a commercial foundation to our activities so that we're sustainable in the long term, financially sustainable, and we have a strong focus on the environment as well, and to be environmentally sustainable too. So those are that's the main thing that I see, and I'm not really coming at it from an academic point of view, but just through practice. That's why we started down the route of social entrepreneurship.
So it's independence from government grant aid, and it's about sustaining a community in the long term.
That's correct. That's right. I don't think we're going to get total sustainability. Well, the model that we have developed is about developing sort of core sustainability, where your core costs are covered and the core activities are covered, and you can operate the community association at a level that is sustainable going forward. And then sort of layered on top of that, that gives us the space to look at grant funding for funding specific projects, and that's layered on top of that. So we're guaranteed that our core costs are covered through the social enterprises that we have, and then we can that gives us the space to develop other environmental projects, other youth projects, arts projects on top of that. And for those projects, we then can apply for grant funding. And because we have social enterprises, then we have some of our own match funding to put against that, which a lot of funders like. So that's the model that we have here.
So we've got into the nuts and bolts of the finance of your social enterprises, but we haven't yet heard what your social enterprise is. So let's start with Carn Tóchar and Pubble Carn Tóchar. Pubble translates from Irish into English as community or even maybe society. So can you tell us about Carn Tóchar? Where are you? Who are you? What kind of a place is it?
Well, Carn Tóchar is a rural area, totally rural area in South County Derry. It's not that far off the main route between Derry City and Belfast on the Glensheen Pass. I don't know if anybody's anybody that's been along the Glensheen Pass, where to the right hand side of Glensheen Pass when you're going towards towards Derry. Our nearest town would be Mahara, and we're about 3 miles outside Mahara. It's a totally rural area. It's a part of a parish. It's not even a parish. Two parishes, actually. So, like many other, if you want to go back to the early 1990s, we were like many other rural areas in Ireland where we were suffering from depopulation. And it was at that stage that we decided that a lot of young families, especially, were moving out of the area to local towns. We were losing a lot of our young people, especially people who went away to university and maybe met somebody else from somewhere else or from Belfast or further afield and got married and didn't come back. So what we wanted to do was we wanted to set up something that would keep people in the area. And that's why we set up the community association. And we had a whole range of objectives in terms of providing housing, developing housing within the local area, developing social services within the local area, developing childcare, developing a range of activities that people want to come and live in the area and bring up their families in the area. And then as well as that, at the core of all of the stuff that we wanted to do was to reinstate the Irish language within our area, which was a Gaeltacht area. Up until the middle of the 20th century, my grandparents were Irish speakers. Most people's grandparents or great grandparents around here would have been Irish speakers, and with the last native speaker dying, probably within living memory of today. But so that was one thing we wanted to do as well. And we also had a strong environmental focus as well. We wanted to reinstate and preserve the environment within the area. On the mountain, there's about 6,000 acres of common land on the mountain, and we had a ancient woodland as well, and bogland and the like in the area. So we had a very broad remit to regenerate the area.
Okay, so the 1990s, people moving away, the better education, people arguably moving away to go to university and not coming back. And I'm very interested in the challenge that you had way back in the 90s and that spark in the community. Can you go back to that time? You know, what kind of people in the community at the time came together? What kind of people were they? How did you all get going? Was it through a parish council? Was it through the GAA? Was it through Irish language classes? You mentioned that the language lasted up to 50, 60, 70 years ago, which is remarkable, given that the language hadn't survived elsewhere. So what was the actual spark that happened in the 1990s that kind of push came to shove, that you came together?
Well, I suppose the area was in a spiral of decline, I suppose, would have been the best way to put it. There is a GAA club in the area, a very, very strong, probably one of the most successful GAA clubs in Ireland, Slachneil, today. But if you go back to the early 1990s, we weren't able to put a minor team. There was no minor team at my age group. And the primary school, the local primary school had less than 50 pupils at it, and declining. So, as well as that, there was an interest in the Irish language, and we wanted to reinstate the language. And that, I suppose all of those things were driving us. And there was a group of people who came together, people like myself. I was young at that stage, just out of university. Most of the other people were older than me, although there was other ones in around my age as well. And it was really just one of the main things was to try and get more housing within the area, try and get a small housing scheme within the area so that people, if they wanted housing, that they could get it. And that was one of our first projects. The other first project that we started up was a preschool, Irish language preschool playgroup. Mm-hmm. So those were the two projects really that we focused in at the start. Whilst we articulated what we wanted to do in the longer term, we started off with two manageable projects, and and focused in on delivering those, albeit the Irish medium one snowballed for us because we ended up setting up a primary school the following year, an Irish medium primary school, and that took up a lot of, that took up 10 years of our lives.
Yeah, so it just happened that at some point people began to say, if we go down any further, it'll be unbearable. Let's get that action going. And Sleacht Níl, even I've heard of how good that club has been in the last few years as somebody who has no particular interest in GAA, although I come from that kind of background. So the club was in decline as well and has managed to turn around.
The club has always been the heart of the community here. It's always been it's a strong club, but just by virtue of the fact of people moving out of the area, it wasn't numbers. No, it was struggling for numbers at that stage. But really, there's been a complete turnaround in that as more and more people have decided to stay in the area and bring their families up in the area. It's got stronger and stronger over the years.
So everything seems to have happened at the same time. Gradually, the GAA club got better as the preschool was established, as the Gaelscoil was established. I suppose it was kind of a snowball effect.
We were really standing on the shoulders of the club, in the sense that the club was a vitally important part of the community, and there's a strong, this is a farming community as well, and there is a very strong community there already. We benefited from that, and it's not to say that it wouldn't have happened anyway, but I think everybody worked together, and what we were doing in the community association, I think, has certainly helped the build the success of the club, as more and more people have decided to settle in the area. One of the first things that I mentioned there was that we got housing. We pushed for a housing scheme in the area. It took us about 7 years to get that. One of the other outcomes of that was that we got designated as a dispersed rural settlement. And for that reason, it was easier to build houses in our area. You could do infill developments between houses in our area long before you could do it in any other rural area. So because we had a long fight with the planners and we took them to a planning appeals commission and we got designation as a dispersed rural settlement, the only one within the whole council area, it meant that it was easier for sons and daughters of people living here to get a house beside their parents' house, or in between infill development, it was called, or cluster development. So that, I think, has been the single biggest factor in us being able to regenerate our rural area, as well as all of the other things that we have built around that.
Okay, so that's interesting. Is that public sector, public housing, like what we might call council housing?
The scheme that we got was a mixed tenure scheme. There were 8 houses on it, 2 private and 6 were a housing association, rural housing association. It's like public sector, but they're all detached houses on a small scheme. But that's really a small part of it. The main part of it was that people were able to build their own houses easier in the area as well. And we were able to get other
planning permission to build other houses in the area.
Still difficult to build them in the open countryside, but we get them more infill developments where people could build them between 2 existing houses in particular.
Well, that leads to the clustering and village development and so on. So it's been quite a long road, and it's interesting that you're involved in all these other activities now, but that the housing was one of the keys, and then that was on the shoulders of the GAA club that already had that sense of community, and you had that network of people involved with it. How did you approach developing the preschool and the primary school that came after that? Was a committee put together, or?
Yes, there was. There was a committee put together. It was located on in a mobile classroom just beside the GAA hall for about 7 or 8 years. The preschool was. The primary school was set up the following year, and it was set up with a different committee. It was a lot of the same people, the parents of the children who first sent their children to the preschool. There were 7 parents who decided that they wanted to set up a primary school, and we set it up as an independent primary school. We spoke to the local English language school to see if there would be the possibility of setting it up as a unit within that at that stage, but there wasn't any appetite for that. So we decided that we would set up a freestanding school at that stage. We went into Mahara, Glen Road in Mahara, and we set it up more or less in the town, or in the town, side of the town next Slachneil, which is, that's where a lot of people from Slachneil sort of over the years have sort of migrated towards anyway. We set it up and we set up a preschool playgroup, a second preschool in Mahara, so that we could build the numbers at the primary school, because there wouldn't have been enough. There certainly wouldn't have been enough numbers in the Slachneil, Cairn Taher area to sustain a primary school. So we set it up in Mahara and we ran it independently without support from the Department of Education for 8 years. In many ways, that was the making of us, in that we had to raise all the money for the primary school. We started off, we had to raise 30,000 a year to pay one teacher. First of all, we had to raise the money to put the buildings in place, which were mobile classrooms. And then we actually put them up without any money. And when we raised the money later, and then for the following 8 years, we had to raise, I started off about 30,000 a year and eventually became 90,000 a year that we had to raise. And we had to beg, borrow and steal for that. And it was probably the worst years of my life in terms of, we didn't know where the next month's salary was coming from. We had to go out to all the GAA matches with buckets, and we had to run all sorts of draws, and we had people doing stuff for us in America, all over the place to try and raise money for us.
It was literally buckets outside the church or outside the GAA club, or donations from abroad and so on. So it was very much...
That's right, yeah. Yeah. Now, that was for 8 years, that's what it was. We eventually then, the local school, because of the conditions that the Department of Education placed on it, we would have had to have 20 pupils a year coming in every year to get funding. And so we decided, right, that rather than drive on for that we would then join in with the primary school up in Turkeyan. At that stage had changed their mind in relation to us becoming a unit within the school. And so we then joined in 2001. We moved back up the road to Slachneil, up into the primary school. It was an arrangement that we would move in until such times as the school was big enough to become a school, a standalone school in its own right. For various reasons, that hasn't happened. That was the plan. But what it did allow us to do, took that the need to raise that level of funding off our hands straight away. And at that stage, or even for a while before it, or it was 2000, it was December 2000, we moved up the road, January 2000, / 2001, we moved up the road. And we then decided to focus in on our community development activities and then develop a whole range of activities, which we had been doing to a limited extent. But because the school was now funded, that allowed us then to focus in on delivering a whole range of community activities, on delivering a whole range of youth activities, especially for children, Irish language activities, because there's very little. Most of the children were coming from English-speaking homes. So what we've been trying to do all the way through is to have the children so that they're able to experience Irish outside of the classroom and develop their fluency and use of Irish outside the classroom.
To normalise the use of the language, exactly, that it belongs outside the classroom in the community as well as the home.
Correct, yeah, yeah. So that allowed us to do that. And really, our activities as a community association have flourished since then. We couldn't believe how easy it was at that stage to get funding for projects. You just filled in a few application forms and you got money, whereas whenever we were raising money for the school, we had to go out and shake buckets and do draws. And there's an awful lot of raising of money in £10,000 that way. Whereas you can get grant funding because we were an educational organisation. We couldn't apply to 95% of the funding bodies because that's a statutory service in their view that the government should be providing. So, but whenever we started developing the community activities, we were able to then apply to the lottery funding. We were able to apply to lots of different trust funds, Department of Agriculture, Rural Development, there were just a whole range of funders that we were able to apply to.
So it just happened to be that there is more funding available for community development, bottom-up community development, than there is for bottom-up education.
Infinitely more. If you're a non-recognised school, you can't apply to any of them virtually. Whereas, no, if you're a school, you can't apply to most of those funders. You couldn't at that stage. So that allowed us to develop the community centre, to start looking at a whole range of projects and activities. And we've just gone from strength to strength ever since.
Evidently, with all the different projects that you're mentioning there. And one of the marks of a successful entrepreneur is learning from mistakes, or adapting as things go along and saying, well, that didn't work, or that opportunity didn't turn out to be as good an opportunity as I thought it would. I'll go this slightly different path. So it sounds like you went that other path into community, and that flourished more because there were funds available. Did you follow the money, or did you stay a bit more true to what it is you wanted to do? Or did you adapt and say, well, look, we can get money to do this other thing. Let's get that up off the ground and come back to our original ideas later on.
No, not really. We decided that we were going to do a range of community development initiatives. One of our core objectives was reinstating the Irish language, but that's not mutually exclusive with developing an environmental project. For example, we are developing a youth project. We just applied to the normal sources of funds for youth projects and for social development, for environmental. But we had a few arguments with funders at the start, but like in a youth project, for example, we put in an essential criterion that the person applying had to be an Irish speaker, and the big lottery questioned that and weren't going to allow us to do that. But it was a community fund at that stage. So we said, look, no, it has to be, because a large proportion of the children within the area are Irish speakers. So, and then we won that argument. And that, and we went to see them. I remember going to see them in Belfast and that. And we've developed a whole range of community projects. It just happens that the people that when we're employing them, one of the criterion is that we're looking for an Irish speaker. If we can then get somebody with an Irish speaker, then we'll look for somebody that's a learner, or somebody that's willing to learn, or has proven that they want to learn. So, for example, one of the projects that we're most proud of is the Nature Reserve. That's not just an environmental project, that's a community development project. We have allotments on the reserve, we have a conservation farm on the reserve, we use the meat from the farm in the restaurant, in the cafe that we have locally here. We use the walkways around the reserve for program of activities, an annual program of activities that includes fitness, keep fit, couch to 5K. We have a lantern walk in the reserve every year. We have a picnic, a spring picnic on it. We have a whole range of activities in the reserve. So it's not just an environmental project. There's a whole range of things, and there's youth. We have it's all mapped out for orienteering. We now have archery on the reserve as well. We have archery tag, which we're developing as well, and we're due to have an official opening very soon. So it's not we tie all of it together. There's Irish language folklore on the reserve. The names of the different parts of the reserve are in Irish. You know, so it's not just an environmental project. There's a whole range. We try and link all of the projects that we do together as best we can.
So you have a nature reserve, which means a bit of land. Who owns all of this, or what's the social enterprise structure, or are you a charity or a community group, or where's the ownership?
Community group. We're constituted as a company, limited by guarantee with charitable status, and the reserve. Part of the reserve, originally when we went we tried to buy the reserve. It was in around the year 2000, and we were still, I suppose, in development stage. We heard that the Woodland Trust had funding. They were prepared to purchase land, and we went to them and we did a partnership with the Woodland Trust where we work with them at a local level in terms of managing the reserve. And they purchased 80 acres at that stage. And that was how it was until about 2012, when another section of ancient woodland, bogland, and grazing, ancient grazing, or very species-rich grazing land. And there's about a mile of a salmon spawning river on it as well. It was almost 130 acres. And we bought that ourselves. So there's a house on that as well, and we've developed a whole range of activities around that. So we own the 130-acre section, and the Woodland Trust own the 80-acre section, but it's seamless between the two. You wouldn't know the difference between the two.
How do you get to a stage where a community group has enough assets to buy 100-and-something acres?
Well, we that was a grant funding. We were able to apply for grant funding for that, because over the preceding years, we'd done quite a lot of work in terms of establishing the biodiversity of the piece of land. We had a good idea that this piece of land was going to come up for sale at some stage. So we had an awful lot of work done in terms of the ecology, assessing the ecology and the environmental importance of the land. So we were then able to go to the Environment Agency, and we went then to the Heritage Lottery Fund as well. And we put some money in ourselves. And we were able to buy it at that stage. So I suppose it was a bit of forward planning. We were able to do the forward planning for that section of it. That was a £600,000 project, because we had established the importance of it from an environmental heritage point of view. It was relatively straightforward, although we were the first non-conservation organization to get any money from either the Heritage Lottery Fund or the Environment Agency to buy land in the north. So that it was a first.
I'm getting tired listening to the amount of energy that was required, or imagining the amount of energy that was required to achieve all of this. And I'm interested in your own background. You're a chartered surveyor, project manager. You've set up your own construction company with a business partner back in the 1990s. So I presume your own business background in establishing an enterprise of your own with your business partner, those skills helped you in the work that you're doing in your own community. What's the kind of background of the other people who work with you in the community on the social enterprises? Would they also come from business backgrounds or other?
A range of people from the past, some from business backgrounds, chief executive of a local authority here as well. We've Padraig O'Meanine, you know Padraig, who's the Irish language dictionary project. And there's a whole range of people from all walks of life, who are from teachers, tradesmen, farmers, every walk of life really has been involved.
And would you say that the motivation, the collective motivation of those people, is it mainly to do with the local community and the land and, you know, the sense of place and belonging and going back generations on this particular, in these particular areas of farming land? Is it the Irish language? What's the main motivation, do you think, or the two or three main motivations of this collective of people?
I would say it's community behind all of those things. It's community, and it's people feeling that they want to. We've developed a vision really for ourselves, for the local community, and a lot of people have bought into that. And there's lots of different aspects to that vision. One would be the environment, one would be the Irish language, the other one would be the arts, the other one is the social side of things. The cafe has been a brilliant project for bringing everybody together here and at a social level. There's lots of different aspects. Some people would be interested in the Irish language part of it more than the rest, and some people would be interested in the environment more than the rest, and some people would be into the arts and music, the drama. So there's something in it for everybody, really.
Yeah, there's something for everybody. You didn't mention the sports, the GAA club.
Oh, well, there's the sports as well. Obviously, that goes without saying. We're all involved with the GAA club in some shape or form. That's right. And that, I think all of those things have worked together to make this a really good place to live and to bring up your family and to have a very high quality of life. And I think all of those things work together to keep people in the area. You couldn't get a site for love nor money in the area if you wanted one to build a house. So it's really, there's been a complete turnaround. At underage level, we have 20 to 30 children in every age group, in every team, you know, which is three times what we had 20 years ago, 30 years ago. So it's somewhere that people want to live, want to bring up their family, are very, very proud of it, proud of the achievements of the club, of what we've done in the community association, and can participate and stuff that they enjoy, and they can have their children, they can be sure that their children are going to have things to do and that they'll enjoy as well outside of school.
By growing up there. You mentioned that you can't get a site to build a house for love nor money. Has that driven people out of the area who can't afford to buy there because wealthier people are able to buy there?
I wouldn't say that, no. I'd say just wealthier people can't buy here because it's nearly all local people. If you have land, if your family has land, that's where you build, and you never ever see a site for sale. It's not even as if anybody, no matter how much they want to spend, could get a site here.
So I suppose I'm thinking of it as the city person not thinking through that a rural community, the land is already owned by the people in the community.
For generations.
Coming back to being an effective social entrepreneur, what would you see as the skills that are required to be an effective or successful social entrepreneur?
I suppose there's a range. Looking at it from our point of view, there's a range of types of social entrepreneurship. You could have pure commercial, business-orientated social entrepreneurship, or you could have people that are involved with maybe delivering a service level agreement for a local council for delivering a service or something like that. But our activities would range from one extreme to the other there. I would say, and if you're looking at setting up a social enterprise, it's exactly the same as setting up a private sector enterprise in terms of the level of commitment and involvement and dedication. And in some ways, there's at least as much work involved in setting up a commercial enterprise as there is setting up a private. So I think the qualities you need are very similar to the qualities that you need in setting up any business. And you need to be a particularly driven type of person. You need to have, if not obsessive in some ways, you need to be very well organized. So we have always, in any social enterprise that we're looking at, we're very, very lucky. There's a manager on site, Claire Dock, who is a real dynamo, and she's the center of all of the stuff that we do and drives a lot of it. I think it's important to have that. And she worked in the private sector before she came to us. It's a very good training ground for anybody and that sees in the private sector. But obviously you can start a social entrepreneurship business without working in the private sector. But I think that drive and a bit of experience is very important, no matter where you get that experience.
So you mentioned a manager working in the centre. How many staff have you got employed, full-time or full-time equivalent at the moment, given all those activities you mentioned? You mentioned the cafe. I know you have a kind of a gift and craft shop as well, and the other arts and nature-based projects.
Including the shop and the cafe and the various projects that we're delivering at Carn. As you can appreciate the cafe, there's quite a lot of people that are part time, and but in terms of full time equivalents, full time we have at the moment there are 7 people working there full time in the centre. That's not counting all of the part time in the cafe or the shop. So You would probably have, I would say, in around about 12 to 14 full-time equivalents on site.
On top of the seven or including the seven?
Oh, that's in total.
In total, yeah. Okay, so so full-time seven people working in the different businesses and so on, and another five full-time equivalent between part-timers or seasonal work.
Yeah, that would include projects. That would include an environmental project, and it would include a youth project as well. So, yeah, that's right.
We mentioned sustainability earlier on, and you were talking about a sustainable community, but I think you're also moving into sustainability in terms of environmental sustainability and energy. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yes, we have a couple of wind turbines here on site, just up the road. And we, a few years ago, whenever the incentives came out for renewable energy production, we decided that we would go down that route. So they're very, very beneficial in terms of helping build the core financial viability of the community association. And we've contributed to the club as well, from those, the GAA club, and to the preschool playgroup. That has been a great project for us. And as you say, it's not just the financial sustainability, it's environmental sustainability as well. So each of those, we have about 350 homes in the area, and each of those turbines generates the equivalent of 150 homes annual energy use. So we're not far off in terms of our domestic sustainability.
So how many turbines do you have already?
There are two.
So there are two. So you have two turbines which can provide energy year round for around the equivalent of 150 homes each.
Yes. Yeah.
And it goes into the national grid.
Yes,
at the moment.
That's right. Yeah. We sell that into the grid, and then we use the money from that to pay off the loans on the. We borrowed money for those, and we're paying those off, paying the loans off, and then there's a surplus then that we use for the community association, for youth activities, for funding. It's been very, very useful in funding the startup costs for the cafe. Without it, we wouldn't have been able to fund that, because it takes a couple of years for the cafe. It took almost 18 months for the cafe to be breaking even. On an ongoing basis, and then unfortunately COVID struck. But we're very confident that we will, as COVID recedes, that we'll be able to continue with that. And we have a very good team there, and we have a very good product, and we have great goodwill from the local community. So we're very confident that we'll go ahead with that. So it's what it has done is it has allowed us a bit of space to develop, to put money into the social enterprise end of things. Yeah,
we have a saying in Irish: "Ar scá chéile a Warren Nadini," that people survive by collaborating or working in each other's shadows and minding each other. Yeah. In a way, your wind turbines are minding your cafe, in that the investment in the wind turbines is helping to develop the cafe.
Yes.
You mentioned that you got some loans. Where do you get the loans from?
There's a group called Community Finance Ireland, and that's who we borrowed. Each of the turbines, we borrowed about £250,000 for each of the turbines from Community Finance Ireland, and raised another 150 on average on top of that for each of them. So,
okay. So Community Finance Ireland would be a social finance investment fund. And had you spoken to the banks, to private banks, to see if they would give you loans, or did you automatically go to Community Finance Ireland?
Well, yes, I had spoken to the banks at the stage, but the banks were looking for personal guarantees and extra collateral over and above what we were able to offer them. And so that would have meant we would... As private individuals on a community association, we would have had to give our own, put up our own houses for equity, to guarantee the borrowing. So no, the Community Finance Ireland was our Ulster Community Investment Trust, as it was then, Yes. Was very good and very easy to work with, and we had borrowed with them already. We developed self-catering accommodation a few years earlier, and we borrowed money off them to help fund that, and that had worked very well. We'd worked well with them, and they were the automatic choice for us to go to for the wind turbines, and they were very interested, and we were able to come to a deal which was similar to the bank rate in terms of the borrowing, but didn't have the same level of security requirement as the bank would have had.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting you mentioned earlier on that the whole aim that you have is to become more independent from grant aid, but you are accessing grant aid as well in order to achieve ultimately to be able to generate your own income from the wind turbines and from the shop, the self-catering and so on.
Yes. Yeah, that's right.
Mm, yeah. So the self-catering again is some more housing, or it's small houses, or?
It's two self-catering units just on the same site as the shop and the cafe. And we also, that's beside the arts centre as well. The shop is run as a social enterprise in its own right. The cafe is run as a social enterprise. And then the arts centre, we have the arts centre which together with the self-catering, and we now have a recording studio in the arts centre, and it's the same person organises the arts centre. You'll see I don't know if you've seen the stuff that we do online, a lot of the stuff's on YouTube that we've done, the concerts we've done all the way through. During COVID, we haven't stopped doing our concerts, we still do them, and they're all online on YouTube. So we now have, just recently, a few months ago, Dermot, the fellow that's in charge of running the arts centre, he'd be involved with music. He plays in a number of bands he's played in the past. He's very, very good technically in terms of sound. He does all the sound and all of the lighting for our concerts and dramas and all of that. And he is now doing sound recording. So we've a good few people have been have used our facilities now for the sound recording. They're only there in the last couple of months. So, and he's developing that now, that end of it. And he has involvement. He has a lot of contacts in the traditional music. And so, what we can do is we can offer. He's developing packages now, and we've taken the time while COVID is on to develop this, and we're looking at developing recording packages for people where they come and they would stay in the houses, and we can do the catering for them. And then we have a recording studio. We also have a hall which is well set up with really good acoustics as well for recording outside of the studio.
Okay, so that's the revenue stream there is renting out the recording studio to people who want to record music.
That's right. And what we're the objective in all of these, I suppose, is for them to at least break even and to hopefully send a surplus back to the community association. And what we have done, the wind turbines, obviously day one, we're sending a surplus back. The shop has been sends a surplus back of between 2,000 to 5,000 a year. And it also pays a bit of rent. And the cafe, it owes us about £12,000 at this stage. Effectively, it started off with zero, and then it got loans, and then it was down to about 20,000 in the red, if you like, with us.
Yeah.
It's come back to about 12,000 now. So our intention is that the cafe then will repay all of the money to us, and then it's already paying a rent to us as well, but it'll repay the money that we've loaned to it, and then it'll start to build a surplus back into the community.
So what's the timeline from when the cafe, when did the cafe open?
It was 2018 it opened.
Okay, so the cafe is 3 years old, and it is gradually eating into the loan you've given.
That's right, yeah.
When do you imagine that the cafe will have repaid its loan and will then be a net contributor financially to the community?
Yeah, well, I would say it will be probably going to be about 12 months, I would say 12 to 18 months, depending on our trading.
Yeah, which has obviously been affected by COVID. So we're talking 5 years for it to begin to be making profit and the profit goes back into the community.
That's right, yeah. And but in the meantime, it's a great meeting place for people. It's been one of the best projects we've done, I think, in terms of our building, putting a heart back into the community, because we were a rural area. There's no other commercial facilities in our area except what we have, the shop and the post office. And up until the cafe opened, there was nowhere where people could get together and sit down and have a cup of tea and a chat. You had to go into Maharaj, you had to go to the nearest town to do that.
So when you say there's a shop, you mean your own shop, you don't mean a private shop? Yeah.
One shop, yeah.
Yeah. A few more questions. All of your activities, they have not displaced anything that any private individual was trying to do in the area, or has it?
No, I don't believe so. No.
So there was no shop, there is no pub, there never was a pub, or if there was, it's long gone.
No, there never really was a pub. No, people would have traditionally gone to Mahara for everything from here.
Okay.
There was never really a shop in our area either.
It's very, very much a rural area that has been built up as this. Have any other private sector businesses sprung up in the area as a result of this kind of ecosystem that you have there?
We have helped private sector businesses. There was a private sector business was based in our centre. Liggett Productions was based there. Sonia Nicolaspig from Gidor. They've since moved back to Gidor, but she still would be very much involved or very much in contact with the area still in terms of the production. She did a programme about the Gael Coliseagh, setting up of the Gael Coliseagh. Which was really, people from this area were key in setting up the Gael Coliseagh. So that's a media company. So that would be one anyway. I can't think of.
Maybe it's a bit early. If we look at it in a longer time span, if you look at Gaeltachtberry is on the Atlantic coast and looking at a time span of maybe 50 years, once all this social enterprise happens, it creates an ecosystem that makes it easier for private individuals to set up a private enterprise, which can provide employment and provide extra services or whatever in the area as well.
From the point of view of the local area, there's effectively full employment here in this area. It's very much construction. An awful lot of people in the construction industry, a lot of construction businesses and subcontractors are based here. We would have, because of our location as well, we're quite close to Belfast, we're quite close to Derry, we're close to Coleraine, Armagh, we're more or less in the middle of the north in six counties. So people can travel nearly anywhere from here. So we have lots of people who are civil servants who can still live here and work anywhere in the north really effectively. So in terms of local enterprise, it's nearly all based around the construction industry, I would say, outside, and manufacturing and the construction industry.
But they would have been there preceding the activities of Pobal Cairn Tóchar.
Well, I suppose a lot of them have developed over at the same time that we have developed over the same time frame. Like I have myself in our business, it's the same. There's been a lot of business development. In the past, there would have been a lot of tradesmen, but a lot of people have grown their businesses into much larger businesses in the interim. So.
Do you think they grew them much larger because of that quality of life in the area, or are other people doing the same in other rural communities?
Well, I would say we have worked alongside a lot of these businesses. The businesses have provided the employment for the people to remain in the area as much as we have provided it, improved the attractiveness of the area for people to stay in. So it's been a happy coincidence maybe that the availability of employment here has developed alongside the quality of life improvement that has happened at the same time. So it's all been a happy coincidence of prosperity.
Well, is it a happy coincidence, or that the community created its own opportunities and was able to exploit those opportunities, so to speak?
I think there's a bit of both, and in the same way that I and others in the business end have spotted the opportunities and developed them for ourselves. A lot of the people that are involved with businesses here are also heavily involved with the GAA in particular, but also the community association too. So there's everybody's boat has risen in that same period. Yeah.
What happened in your community that hasn't happened in other similar rural communities, and why did it happen? You know, do other communities come and ask you, you know, what did you do? How did you manage to do it? We'd like to do the same, because there's plenty of depopulated, you know, other areas as well.
Yes, we have lots of people, and we have people coming over from Scotland there every year as well, from Solmore Ostig in particular, to see what we've done in terms of the language reinstatement. But I would say that one thing that we have done differently from most has been our strong focus on reinstating our language and our culture and the environment as well. I think that a lot of people are attracted to those aspects of it, and it's really reconnecting people with their environment, reconnecting people with the linguistic heritage that is still, by the way, the older people especially here still speak plenty of Irish, but they don't realize it. They use lots of Irish words. All of the family nicknames are still in Irish. The field names,
for example.
Yeah, well, there's Paddy Arts and the Paul Dennys and the Fadgies. The name I grew up with, names like Andy Padamnik. That's Andy Pat Domnick.
The old traditional.
Andy Pat Domnick are the
son of Pat, son of Domnick.
Paddy Arts and
yes,
Paddy Himmy, and those names, people would still identify with those names.
Okay.
You know, with their family names from a few generations back. So yeah, there's still that. And the field names, we gathered up a couple of hundred Irish language field names here. So I would say the level of commitment, because it's the language, because we have been involved parents, a lot of the parents, especially at the start, took an active role in raising money for the school, and they bought into that and were a part of it, there's that sense of ownership that developed, probably helped us as well. A great affinity for the language here, for reinstating the language. The local primary school, there's 100, and this September there'll be over 180 children at the Irish medium part of the school, and there'll be late 75 children at the English medium end. So it's something that has really taken off, and it's something that people are very proud of. We now have the Gael College as well.
So a second level school.
Yeah. So we have post-primary Irish medium here as well, and that has developed a whole generation now of children who speak Irish naturally outside the classroom, without any inhibitions at all in the community. We have lots of, if you go into the shops in the town, there's lots of people working in the shops that are have gone through Irish medium education, and you can speak to them in Irish. Like, the language has been normalised in the area.
So when you say the town, you mean in Mahara?
In Mahara, yeah.
And the seven people working full-time, is their working language Irish or Irish and English? Or
it would be a mixture of Irish and English. We have people, anybody that's working directly with the youth, they're all Irish speakers. Jerma that I mentioned that does the arts project, he's an Irish speaker. The shop and the post office, and the shop, post office, stroke the cafe, they would have at weekends, and not everybody is an Irish speaker in there, learners, mostly learners during the week, but at the weekends, the youth from the area, all of the young people that work in the cafe at the weekend are all Irish speakers. So you can be guaranteed you go in on a Saturday or over the summer holidays, everybody's an Irish speaker virtually. So,
and if I walk in as a stranger, will it be obvious to me that I can do my business in the cafe through Irish, or do I have to kind of make a point of it?
No, what we've done in the cafe, anybody goes into the cafe, they're greeted in Irish, first of all. And then if they're greeted back in Irish, then they speak in Irish. So there's a sort of a protocol that we go through with the children. Well, Jimmer Tatu or Giaditch, whatever, imagine why. And if the person answers them in English, then it's obvious they're not going to be doing it. Or if they attempt to answer them in Irish and they're a learner, and then you have to, you know, they're educators then of that person. Or if they're fully fluent in Irish, they speak to them in Irish while they're there. Our biggest problem in terms of expanding our social enterprises is, and we have another social enterprise that we would like, we've actually two that we have in the pipeline at the minute. One of them is Spree, CIC, which is an outward bound company. I'd mentioned that we have archery tag on the reserve, and we have orienteering and
adventure sports or outdoor sports.
Doing outdoor sports, and we would like to develop that through Irish and for the Irish language primary schools and for Irish language youth groups as well as, but there's nothing stopping us delivering it in English as well. So, but it's vital that we get the right person in place there to develop that. Well, that's one. And the other one is childcare. We have plans to develop full childcare on the site of the old where the primary school used to be in Mahara. So the difficulty in developing both of those is the availability of people who have the skills or have the experience and qualifications, but also have Irish. That's our biggest constraining factor, and it's great that DCU have identified that as a need and are addressing it, and it's something that we would like to work with DCU on going forward in terms of maybe people from this area deciding to go and study, and we've already mentioned to you about maybe speaking to the people in the Gael College.
Yes, certainly.
Or people that are already studying that want an opportunity.
Yeah, well, that's you've brought me to one of the next questions that I wanted to ask you was, do you have any links in your community with any universities or higher education institutions, and what kind of links would you be interested in?
Well, we have in the past been worked with the science shop, and yeah, we would be interested in working with universities. I mentioned Soil Mór Ostaig in Scotland.
An Irish language centre in the Isle of Skye, is it? Irish language, Gaelic.
So they were coming over maybe a couple of times a year there until COVID. The last time they were here was probably last January, before COVID. February, I think it was about February. It's just over a year ago. So they haven't been back, obviously, with COVID. But that's really, I suppose, University of Ulster to a limited extent. But no, we would be very interested in developing our relationship with. Like, we're happy to host any visits or that the universities would like to make. That's what we do with Soil Mór Ostaig. We put on a program for them for when they're over.
Yes.
The last time they were over, we were over and we put on a program for them, and there just happened to be a match on over at the GAA club that evening. And we said, well, there happens to be a match. Do you want to go over and see the match? And it was just a league match between Slathneale and Glen Mahara, the town, our local town here. And we went along, and there were probably 6,000 people at the match. It was standing room only, and they were saying they couldn't believe that this was a wee local club league match, and there were that many. They were saying, like, Inverness Caledonian Thistle wouldn't have a quarter of it.
Yeah.
You know, so they were very taken by the whole thing and the fact that the sport's there and we have the language and the environment and all of that was they're just blown away by it, by all of the stuff that's going on.
Speaking of students coming to visit, coming back to the whole area of a career in social enterprise, what advice would you be giving students who aspire to pursuing a career in social enterprise community development?
I don't know how well I'm placed to provide advice to them, but what I would say is...
Well, look at all your achievements. You've been involved since the beginning.
Yeah. I would say it's worth... I think looking at their where they want to go and what they want to achieve, what their own abilities are, playing to their strengths, and looking at gaining as much experience as they can, be that in the private sector or in the voluntary sector first before they would embark on any a social enterprise of their own, I suppose. Setting up a social enterprise from scratch as a standalone business, if you like, is not everybody's cup of tea. There's an awful lot of work in doing that. It's like setting up any private sector business. There's marketing, there's administration, there's human resources, there's property issues. There's a whole there's an awful lot of aspects to it. And if you are setting up a business, I would say get a bit of experience first, or get I think mentoring is very important. If you don't have the experience, there's no point in reinventing the wheel. Take advice. Or if they want to just get into the sector and get a bit of experience first working on other social enterprises, I think that would be
get
the experience, build the experience, or partner with somebody or get a mentor from somebody who has the experience. It's important because a lot of people, and I've seen it, get involved with a social enterprise and where people have gone into it full of energy, full of ability, but due to lack of experience or for whatever reason, it hasn't worked out. But it's normally down to lack of experience and maybe making mistakes that they could have avoided, you know. So it's, I would say, talking to people, getting the experience, or getting somebody to mentor you would be very important.
Would be a key, which brings us back to the title of our project here, From Passion to Action, where you can be passionate about an issue, but how do you make those changes? How do you effect the change? How do you act and so that you can achieve what it is you want to achieve, whatever it is you're passionate about? Mm-hmm. One last question, as we're bringing things to a close, Neil, is everything you do seems to be for the community, for the local community. So there's a sense of ownership and involvement there. Do people from outside the area come in either as tourists staying overnight or, you know, outsiders, let's say, coming in to the cafe, the shop, the outdoor activities and so on? Or is your customer base mainly your own local community?
No, I would say our customer base is it's our local community. It's the wider community of sort of greater Mahara area. And even for the shop, it would be beyond that. You would have people coming from much further afield for the shop. The cafe, even people would come from a bit further afield as well. They would come for a walk in the woods or on the mountain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so people would come to do a walk and maybe go for a bite to eat in the cafe and then go home. We would have people even coming from Belfast to do that, you know, so or Derry or wherever.
I was at a session recently to do with the community and voluntary sector, and somebody asked a question: should we be promoting the fact that we're a social enterprise, or should we just say this is what we do, come and use our services. So do people come to enjoy your shop, your cafe, the experiences that you provide because they're good in themselves, or do you think they're coming because it's a social enterprise they want to support?
I would say there's a bit of both there, but what I would say is that if you're doing a social enterprise, the standard of service needs to be as good as the best private sector. So, you know, first and foremost, they're coming because they like what we're offering. I think most of them, even and as well as that, they're happy to support a social enterprise. But if the service wasn't good, if the food wasn't good, it doesn't matter if you're a social enterprise or not. They wouldn't come back. But no, I think it is a wee bit. It's a bit of both, and even within the same person, it's a bit of both, because they want to buy something in the shop, but they want to support the social enterprise and the community.
So do you promote yourselves as a social enterprise, or just this is a good shop, this is a good craft shop, this is a good mountain trail, this is a good outdoor pursuits?
We don't really promote ourselves as a social enterprise, I would say, but most people know that's what we are. So no, we don't lead with that. No.
Mm. Okay.
And we're always developing and thinking of new products as well. And that I think that's an important thing. Even a private sector, that's what private sector does, and that's what we need to do. Like for example, in the shop, we have our own ranges of stuff, but we're now developing printed clothing range as well, and printed there's a whole range of printed material in Irish that we're developing, including clothing. So that's our next sort of small project within that social enterprise, within the cafe within Ancree. We have our kiosk. We have a kiosk that we set up whenever we weren't able to open the cafe during lockdown. We set up a kiosk over on the nature reserve because everybody was using the nature reserve for walking, for recreation. So we set that up. So you have to be light on your feet as well, like any business, and that's what we would pride ourselves in.
You were selling your coffees or your takeaway soup or whatever. I like the phrase light on your feet, because that's something that successful enterprises of any kind need to be able to do, is respond to the changes that happen in the environment. Neil, Míle Mahagat, thank you very much. It's more in place your lay of a glart lat for yorbert fubble gaelge charn tocher. It's great to be discussing with you how the Irish language has been revived, or that ye have revived the Irish language in your community. It's a shining light. I love the way you've connected it with the local environment, the field names, the local culture, this whole sense of place, which I think is increasingly important to us. And we've realized that over the last more than a year with the pandemic, that our own local places have a lot to offer to us, and that there's a lot of strength in being rooted with your own identity and heritage.
Garamagat hien agus be mila falte roat agus rav kibé danya tagiri chacht ham.
Well, shinne bevralum, ma tha cadagwing dolat hashtil in san olskol bevralum na miklein a horter court. Hugget, I think it would be an amazing field trip for students to come and see everything. Maybe time our visit with one of the matches on with the famous Duchnail GAA club. Yes. Yep. So, Gormila Mila Mahagat, Neil.
Gormagat, Ian.
If you'd like to find out more about the work being done by Neil and the community in Carn Tóchar, you can visit their website at oncarn.org.